episode 34. Here we go. My guest today is David Dufresne, a partner in one of Canada's most active venture capital funds, Panache Ventures. I mean, you know the old saying on the cereal box, with a name like Panache, it has to be good. Listen to me, this is a big deal. Prior to his role at Panache, David was the head of strategy and growth at Bandcamp, and prior to that, he was the CEO of the popular website service Bandzoogle. This is the first venture capitalist we've had on the show, so if you ask me, it's pretty monumental, and I loved hearing David's opinions about all kinds of things happening in the industry. You know, he's kind of like an insider-outsider. He's been in the industry. He now works very closely with the industry, but he's kind of on the other side looking in. And I really just enjoyed what he had to say. It was kind of refreshing. I learned a lot. There was a ton of great insight. And I loved hearing about some of the companies that Panache is investing in that they're hoping is going to change the industry. I mean, that's what we're here. That's what it's all about. Am I right? So here we go. I'm not going to give too much away. David Dufresne, episode 34. Here we go. Well, I'm curious, actually. I don't know if you follow this or you're connected with it, but I'd kind of love to get your opinion on this. And you may even shoot this down. Quibi, like obviously a couple days ago, just totally shut down. Any thoughts as an outsider, like what happened there? Can too much money be a bad thing for a startup?
Yes, absolutely. Because then the problem of venture capital is that you're supposed to spend it. So when you get too much too early, you might end up like hiring like some people ahead of time for certain roles. You might end up doing things like throwing like lavish launch parties that where that money could have. But I don't know, like I haven't followed Quibi all that closely, but man, content plays are really hard to do at scale. I think it was an attempt to change people's behavior or predict that people's behavior was gonna, like I think the pandemic probably didn't help them because if it was going to be kind of a Netflix that you watch on your way to work or when you have 10 minutes in between meetings or
nobody's traveling,
everyone's at home and everyone has time to watch, four seasons of Netflix.
It kind of feels like they were sort of like, I look at the content creator that's exploding right now, TikTok, their whole mantra is like, we're here to help creatives or we're here to make your day. Like they're all about happiness, creativity. We're here to help the creative. We're here to make you happy. Kind of felt like Quibi never had that mission statement. It almost felt like they were like, you're gonna watch on your way to the waiting room because we tell you to. Like, it almost felt like it wasn't as their intentions weren't as pure. I mean, I don't know. That's just as an outsider, kind of.
Yeah, you're probably right. Like, from a consumer perspective, they, like Disney, like was smart, right? They gave us the Mandalorian, where like instinctively, and Baby Yoda. It was like, man, I I'm gonna pay for that. So I didn't watch Quibi, so I don't know. So probably that's I'm part of the problem. But
I didn't watch. I was excited when it came out. I thought this is gonna be cool, and then I didn't watch. Apparently, only 3 million people did. So
and at the same time, I mean, like we're used to short form content on YouTube, and so I think they were trying to be like a hybrid between like the behaviors. Your TV watching or video watching behaviors on Netflix and on YouTube, which, and sometimes when you try to be too many things at once or kind of a bastard child of two existing behaviors, it's really hard to do well. But you're probably right. Like, raised too much money too early. Probably worked on too much content. They should have maybe have only a few a few properties, a few pieces of IP with recognizable names. And
it's kind of the choice issue people don't like choice. Like they like, I feel like if they'd come out with like less content, that might've benefited them. Maybe, I don't know. I'm making this up.
Yeah, it's like when you go to the supermarket and there's like 80 brands of pasta sauce and you're like, man, right. I just want to eat spaghetti. And yeah.
And you end up not buying anything.
<I don't know. laughs>
So how many decks do you look at each week? Are you always looking at decks?
Always. Depends on the week, but it's probably at least like on an average regular day, I probably get exposed to 4 or 5 new decks. But like yesterday, I did like 7 back-to-back one-on-one meetings with startups that were out of an Ottawa-based incubator or accelerator. So some days are more like active on the deal flow side of things. Like right now, we have a small team, right? So often it's going to be our analysts that kind of do a first pass. Like we'll look at the decks as they come in and then flag the ones that they think fit with our criteria. So yeah, so it depends on the day.
What do you look for in a deck? Like, do you like seeing stuff that's more detailed? I heard you say you saw a deck where the CEO was making 300,000 a year and you said pass. What do you look for? What's a deal breaker?
I look for like potential scale, right? So I look for big ideas. Like if you're going after a massive problem, like I'll be more interested if you're going after a niche problem or
you're more interested.
I'm more interested by a massive opportunity. And sometimes it's hard to decipher from just a deck. Like what I'm trying to understand is the opportunity. Is this something that could become a $1 billion company if you make the assumption that it's going to work?
Right.
And I'm trying to see is what the ambition is. Like where do you predict you're going to be in 2, 3 years and 5 years? So often the deal breaker is that I'm going to look at something, it makes sense, but it is in such a niche industry or geography, or it's in a market that's already very fragmented. My feeling is that there's a chance to build a very nice business, but not a venture scale size business.
If the deck is trash, but you go, wait a second, this actually could be a good company. Is the deck being trash, is that a turnoff?
You mean in terms of design or in terms of content? Because I don't care about the design aspect all that much, unless you're like a marketing tech startup with shitty fonts and like horrible layouts. But I think when you're pitching your startup, it's not that different than when you're selling your product. So if you're like your sales brochure, right, which is your deck, is terrible, then I'll make the assumption that you're not that good at selling your product or your technology either.
So it comes together.
It comes together. But sometimes the problem now is that I think the science of putting a deck together is like easy. You just need to read a few blog posts and getting good designers to make your deck look good is not that expensive now. So we see a lot of really great looking decks that have all the right content in the right order. But when you stop and think about the underlying business opportunity, like it's not that exciting.
It's deceiving. The high quality deck can be deceiving. So, but like a simple deck, great ideas. That's valid. That makes sense. It doesn't matter.
The deck is just an excuse. Like the goal of a deck is to get a meeting, right? So like the best decks, I think, tell the narrative and tell the story, but then not too many details. Cause what you really want is for the investor to say, all right, I'm going to spend half an hour or an hour with this founder and find out the whole story.
So what do you ask? Like when you sit down with a founder for half an hour, is there a first question like, okay, pitch me like for a minute or how do you start the conversation? What are you trying to learn?
I often start meetings by saying, so what are you working on? Like I keep it loose just to see how they're going. Like I'm interested in what's their narrative, right? So I don't start by saying, okay, how many sales do you have? What's your revenue? Or do you have patents or things like that? Like I'd like for them to tell the story because that tells me a lot about how they thought about the business and how they pitch it, again, like the narrative they tell me is probably the similar narrative that they tell their potential customers. So usually I start, I let them talk, might interrupt with questions or ideas, but I save the bulk of the questions or maybe the things they didn't mention for after they've kind of told me their story and their pitch.
And then,
These days, most conversations start about how is your lockdown or how how is your life affected by COVID-19 and things like that. I mean, we might talk about American politics for a few minutes. But,
Well, I was going to ask because I was talking with an A&R guy at a label who's taking all these meetings over Zoom right now with different artists. And I was like, is it harder to get a sense of their star power over Zoom? And he said, you know what? If I can sense their star power over Zoom, I feel like, and he's like, we're testing this theory right now, but he's like, I feel like how strong is it going to be in person when I'm in the room with them or I'm seeing them play, if they can capture me on Zoom. Is that like, or, I mean, I guess it's a little different with the VC fund because it's much more conversational based, but does that play a role? Like how is it harder making these types of decisions over Zoom versus staying face to face with them?
That's a good question. It's definitely different. Is it harder? I do think so. I do think you lose a lot of quality. Why? Because you don't get all the body language, and especially when you talk to teams, to see how two co-founders will interact together, and the little glances, the nasty looks they'll throw at each other. Like, you lose some of that intangible dynamics. But at the same time, you don't have to travel. You don't have to go from office to office. Right now, if you're in Nashville, it's as easy to speak with an investor
with you in
New York,
Canada. And
yeah, I'm in Canada, and we're talking now. And so there are pros and cons, I guess. But I do miss and one thing I miss is actually visiting startups. Like going to see their office, seeing how their employees are set up, seeing just the vibe of the place. And you can tell if people are dynamic or if everyone's wearing their headphones and not talking to each other or looking frustrated.
What are some fun things that you've seen at startups in offices? Like anything crazy or anything that stands out?
Yeah, you'll go to startups and see dogs walking around and a lot of skateboards and a foosball table with four people around it. And, a board table that probably costs more than my car. And then you'll get to your next meeting and everyone seems so focused. Like there's no art on the wall. I'm not saying one is worse than the other, but it tells you a lot about how is this startup attracting talent? Because their work environment is a big part of it, right?
I just like the good snacks. That's all I request.
Snacks are important. Good coffee, I think, has become a good coffee. Good Wi-Fi is probably the basic standard.
Right. No, absolutely.
Chairs, but yeah.
I know my last job, I had the worst chair ever and it genuinely made me pissed. I was so mad about it. And they had a better chair when I interviewed, I swear. And when I came in on the first day, they swapped out the chairs. They knew exactly what they were doing. So how do you become the CEO of Bandzoogle? Were you involved with Chris at all or how do you take over the company?
Well, taking over is a big word. The story there is that I was working as a venture capital associate at a firm that is now named Really Ventures. And I was at a point where I actually wanted to launch my own startup. So I had started working on a business plan and business model for something it was going to be called Backfed. A little wordplay on feedback and the closest thing to it now, and keep in mind that was back in 2008 and 2009, so the closest thing to it now is Patreon. It would probably have evolved into something that looks like Patreon, and that was pre-Kickstarter, pre-crowdfunding, so it was kind of a wild idea then. So I had started talking to people, looking for a technical co-founder. I had launched events in Montreal for people interested in music tech, and got a mutual friend to invite Chris to it, because I knew he had already had musicians as customers on his platform. And we started talking, took a few meetings, and became clear that he was basically a tech guy that had been looking for a business partner, and that was a business dude that was looking for a technical co-founder. So we kind of made a deal where I joined this company as CEO, And our plan then was to like optimize what it was doing with Banzoogle, grow the company, and eventually either sell it and maybe work on my idea, or within the company, find a way to build it. Things went into all kinds of direction after that, but that's how I joined the company.
What was the space at the time? Because I kind of remember like building a Banzoogle page, being really intimidated with any other website builder and being like, screw it, I'll just do Banzoogle. Like, was that kind of, that was kind of the thing at the time for bands building websites, right?
Yeah, I mean, you had, at that time you had, like a lot of people were still on MySpace.
Right.
Some people were on Reverb Nation. Host Baby, so CD Baby's platform was kind of the closest competitor. But most people were like getting a guy or a gal to build a website for them, either using WordPress or just coding it down right in HTML. So Banzoogle was one of the first platforms that kind of made it easy for anyone to do it by themselves.
And how did you go about, I mean, cause you started acquiring companies like OneSheet, you started putting in all these other features. Like how did you go about scaling it or building the platform?
Well, that's kind of part of the story. The first decision, or one of the first decisions that we made, was to rebuild the whole thing. Because when Chris had got started, he kind of had thought himself a programming language and started building the platform. And it's a pretty like intricate platform, right? Because Banzoogle is one, is like multiple products, because there's a website, but there's also a calendar, there's a music store.
Right.
Photo gallery. Yeah. Like these are all, there's a mailing
list. It all has to be seamless and it all has to drop and plug and play.
And like and there's like 20 different startups that do one of the things that Banzoogle does, right? But the problem is that the programming language he had picked was not supported anymore, and it was like we were in a situation where like coding a new feature was something that should have taken a couple days, but would end up taking 2 months just because like the existing code base was so much like spaghetti and like too much technical debt. So the first decision we made was to change the programming language, like freeze the existing platform, code a completely new one, rebuilding the same features.
And was that hard to do while having people's websites up? Like was the transition hard or was it pretty seamless?
Well, we ran into all kinds of problems. We thought it would take, you know, 6 months to a year, and it ended up taking up to 3 years. And the main problem is that during that time, right, the existing customers, like at some point, figured out that we weren't building any new features in kind of the legacy platform. Like it didn't affect the business too much because, like in parallel, I was building relationships and increasing the brand recognition and getting more users in. So we kept growing the customer base. But we had a increasingly vocal group of customers saying like, when are all the new features coming? It probably felt stale for a little while. And then when we finally transitioned to the new platform and started adding new themes and templates more regularly, things kind of came back to normal. And the few acquisitions that we made, I mean, two of them were basically companies where we acquired their customers, so small acquisitions. And the OneSheet acquisition was like we had ideas to launch a similar product, kind of bring the concept of having a micro website, but we ended up not really spending much time on it.
Did you consciously think, like I remember using Banzoogle and kind of being like, this is kind of made to be fun. First of all, it's kind of a fun name. I remember the instructional tone was very loose, or it was almost like playful, very colorful. Was that kind of intentional that you were like, we're dealing with musicians and artists, we have to make this kind of a fun product or a fun thing, even though it's a website, we have to make this exciting?
Well, Chris still is, I guess, but Chris is a bassist. It's like he, before launching Banzoogle, like he played in a band that like almost made it, like in the Montreal and Canadian rock scene, but kind of stayed under the radar. Then worked for a label, and that's like at the label he got the idea of building this platform. So he's a musician. All the first people he hired were all musicians. Like I think when I joined, I was the only non-musician like guy on the team. So like this is a company where the people building the product and supporting the customers really understand them, because they've been there, they've had bands, they have bands, they have studios or producers themselves.
Right.
So I think getting that right tone is probably easier when you understand your customer, profoundly, because you are also the customer. So that's that's definitely one of the part of the secret sauce of that company.
And now they're doing like, it was just announced during the pandemic, they did 5 million in sales, their artists have earned 5 million in total in sales. Like they're still, or it feels like now they're still relevant, right? They're still.
I mean, one of the things that sets BandZoogle apart from the other platforms is that they don't take a cut of your sales, right?
Right.
So all the revenue that happens on your website, whether you're selling MP3s or CDs or vinyl, or concert tickets, or people are donating through a tip jar, like 100% of that, like less the, I guess they use, I don't know if they use Stripe nowadays, but minus the payment processing goes straight in the artist's pockets. So I think through COVID, like they built or highlighted some of those features so that it made it easy for fans to go and support the artists directly. And yeah, I saw the announcement of, I think 5 million over the last few months. So that's amazing.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. Really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show.
Okay, wait. So how do you decide to go to Bandcamp from BandZoogle? And I'm curious, you were like CEO, big man in charge, and then you went over to Bandcamp. You had a very respectful role, but did you kind of miss being like the big guy in charge of the company?
Yes and no. I think, so first things first, like I think both BandZoogle and Bandcamp are two of the, and both are still, alive and thriving and doing really well. But both are also two companies where the ethics and the reason behind the company, why they do it, is really for artists first. And so, while I was at BandZoogle, I admired Bandcamp quite a bit for it, because like a lot of my favorite bands were on Bandcamp, and I was seeing their feature set, and I was feeling it was very complimentary to what BandZoogle was doing. So one of the things we ended up doing is I convinced Ethan Diamond, who's the founder and CEO of Bandcamp, to do a technical integration with BandZoogle. So that if you're a BandZoogle customer, you have a website on our platform, with a few clicks, you could import your Bandcamp music on your BandZoogle website. And if people wanted to buy on BandZoogle, it was sending them to Bandcamp. So it made it easy to kind of merge your two presence. And so we got to know each other that way. Went to meet him a few times in San Francisco back then. And then at BandZoogle, I got to a point, like to make a long story short, like BandZoogle is very... is a very healthy company that is growing very organically. Never took any outside funding on purpose, only reinvested its own profits to grow, but at a steady pace, right? Very slow organic growth. After almost 5 years there, I was kind of feeling like I had done what I could do for that company, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
and I had all these like VC instincts kicking back in to, go faster, go into new markets, internationalize the platform, and conquer Latin America. And Chris, who was still, I was CEO, but Chris was still a founder, and majority owner of the company. Like his intentions was to keep it small and organic. So we kind of like amicably. And at that point, like I was having these more and more involved conversations with Ethan at Bandcamp about his own strategy and what he wants to do with the company. So made the decision to leave Banzoo. It was a tough decision because I loved that company. It was just like I was making like nice amounts of money in the industry I love, but I was ready for a new challenge. And shortly after, like came to an agreement with Bandcamp and joined them as a full-time consultant, basically.
And was that, because Bandcamp's getting like a lot of press right now just because of the nature of the product. Can Bandcamp kind of scale and move more into the mainstream? Like it feels like it's still a niche thing, but can Billie Eilish go on Bandcamp? Like can more mainstream artists start getting, I know they can, but what's kind of stopping them from it?
I think the company culture is not to grow at all costs. Like similar to Banzoogle, like Bandcamp is growing nicely organically. It's a bigger company than Banzoogle. But I mean, you're never going to see Bandcamp advertise or sponsor the festival or like that decision. One of the decisions that the company made while I was there was to expand its editorial, like create an editorial team and have a lot more articles written every day about the music that was on Bandcamp. So all of that promotion, I guess, or the content that you'll see on Bandcamp is always about the artists and the music, never or very rarely about Bandcamp itself. So, and you know, it's not a company that's looking to partner necessarily with a lot of companies just to get new users. One thing that they've done well in the last few years is build out more features for labels. And it's become a lot more label friendly. So I think nowadays, like most of the larger independent labels are on Bandcamp and do use it. In parallel though, I mean, less and less people are buying music as more people like subscribe to streaming platforms.
Right.
I still think like Bandcamp keeps growing. I think partly because people will find music there they won't find anywhere else.
Yeah.
I also think that when people buy music on Bandcamp, like they make a statement as much as a purchase because they're supporting the artist. And there a lot of the sales now are merch, like vinyl, t-shirts. So I think, and as like the iTunes, not really like Apple's not really trying to sell you MP3s anymore. So I think it's become the de facto store for online downloads for people that still want online downloads or owning that music for a lot of indie artists and a lot of indie labels.
Why though, I know they can, but why don't they advertise or try to promote themselves more? I mean, I understand they're trying to keep it kind of small, but when you think like, you know, this is a product that artists can value from, the mission statement is we're here to help artists, let's get as many artists as possible. Like why don't they try to promote themselves a little more?
I think it's a company culture. I mean, it's a startup it's a company that was founded by engineers that love the product and love building features and like it don't lives. Really just... like the rest of it. Like don't really like the rest of the industry or like having to deal with, you know, business BS or like it's smart people with really good ethics and really good intentions. But they are solely focused on building the best platform for musicians and labels and fans and not all that interested by anything else.
The thing that I like about Bandcamp is I used to actually buy CDs, even though I was like maybe a little past the CD time, but I used to buy CDs. I used to go to the store. I like the limitation of it, where now I have more music than ever, obviously, on Spotify, and I listen to none of it. I used to go into the city, buy a CD or two or three, come home, and because I paid my hard-earned money for it, I would listen to the CD, I would learn the album intimately. I don't think I've learned an album intimately since I bought a CD, an entire album. But when I go on Bandcamp and when I buy something, I feel a reason that now I have to listen to this project and learn about it intimately and really kind of sit with it. To me, that's kind of the cool thing about Bandcamp.
I think Bandcamp. Yeah, I agree 100%. And I'm still a huge like user of the platform. I got one of the things, like a lot of people, I listen to a lot of music. I'm the kind of, in your circle of friends, I'm the guy that always has new bands that they force you to listen to. And a lot of it I still discover through Bandcamp, because I set up my Facebook to see their editorial posts first.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I something that we built on like internal hackathon is called a Bandcamp new tab. So every time in your Chrome browser or Firefox that you open a new tab, you get a Bandcamp album, like a random Bandcamp album. So very often I'll do that. I'll get an album. The artwork looks great. I'll press play and discover new music like that. So I agree. I think it's I kind of compare this to the slow food movement, if you know what I'm talking about. Like people taking the time to prepare food or go to restaurants and you know, like I think part of the music consumption behaviors now is, you know, Spotify playlists, YouTube, random shuffle singles, like on the fly, like Bluetooth. And then you at some point you want to come back, slow down, take some time to search and discover new music, maybe put on a vinyl record that you have to stand up to go to
right
the table and get it out of the, you know, getting out of the sleeve and delicately put the needle on it, and then have to go through all of site A. Like that's counterintuitive, but I think it's a different way to enjoy and listen to music. And Bandcamp is kind of in between, you know, those two types of behaviors, because it's definitely a slower music platform than the main DSPs and yeah, Apple Music and Spotify.
I what you said about the artwork, I feel like bands on Bandcamp have great artwork. They put a lot of thought into it. It's always interesting. I feel like a lot of label, like major label artwork, is like picture of the face. That's cool, but it's like Bandcamp has their artwork. The bands on Bandcamp have their artwork down.
I've seen some horrible artwork on Bandcamp. I mean, that's the beauty of Bandcamp. Like everything is.
It's all there.
But you and your listeners should try the Bandcamp new tab thing.
I'm going to try that.
Because you do see a lot of amazing artwork. And sometimes I'm like, I'm in a call. Like I can't really stop to listen to music. I'm like, oh. I'm gonna leave that tab open, get back to it later, because the artwork looks good. Sometimes the music's horrible or really not in my tastes, but it's, you know, it's a good way. It's the same thing as when you used to go to a record store and you get drawn to a CD just because the artwork was amazing. Like might have not heard the music. You're like, okay, I'm interested in that band because I like the artwork. I think you get some of that on Bandcamp as well.
Right, totally. So really quickly, I mean, tell my listeners about Panache in case they're unaware. So what, like, how did you guys come together? What's the mission statement? Or how do you guys work? Like, what's the ethos of the fund?
So we got together, I guess our team got together, just after I left Bandcamp. Our goal was to create a pre-seed and seed stage VC firm focused on the Canadian ecosystem. Because for many reasons, Canada right now is having a really good moment in tech. Like a lot of talent is coming to Canada. The cost base to launch and operate a startup is much lower. At the same time, like the overall ambition and the like success stories like Shopify and Lightspeed Retail, like are kind of like pulling everyone up and like increasing the overall ambition of the ecosystem. So we thought it was a good time to like place a major bet on a lot of Canadian startups. So we created this created this firm where our goal is to invest in mostly Canada. As of today, we've made about 75 investments, and I think 60 of them are in Canada, and a few of them in the US and one in Israel. Across sectors. So like I was coming from music tech, but like we're not focused on music or entertainment. We've made a few deals in music and entertainment, but a lot in fintech or real estate tech, marketing tech. So that's Panache. I do get a lot of deal flow in music tech because of my background. And so we've made a few deals, but our real focus is Canada. but in across sectors.
What is the, I think, like, historically, at least since the Napster era, like, music tech companies or VC funds have always kind of been very cautious around music tech companies for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that? Or as an investor, like, what makes you sleep at night to invest in a music tech company? Like, what makes you comfortable to put your money into a music company?
Not a lot of things make me comfortable. It's a tough industry. I mean, the thing, like, if you look at music tech, there's kind of two, well, I would say three broad categories, right? There's startups that are around content, that want you to listen to music, discover music, but need like, content, right?
Like Bandcamp, is that an example of?
Well, Bandcamp, no, not really Bandcamp, but every app out there that's about, well, like every Spotify lookalike, or every app that's about discovering new music, or like needs content. So if you need content, you need licenses. And that will, like, unless you're at scale, it will kill any business model, right? So that part is really hard to do. The second category is if you're building technology for the industry. So and there, Bandzoogle and Bandcamp are excellent examples. But then you're selling technology to artists and to labels, which is a tough market to scale into. Like, artists, the vast majority are starving, or like they won't pay millions of, or, thousands of dollars a month for a piece of technology. So you're kind of limiting the scale of what you're doing by going after a market that doesn't have big budgets to spend on technology. And then the third bucket is people building like technology and like Audible Reality, which is one of our investments, is that
the kind 3D of audio company.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
This is technology that could get licensed to all the music platforms out there, eventually to all the device manufacturers. Like, they just announced a deal with a headphone manufacturer or design company. Like, this is tech that can transcend like the two other buckets. So for VCs, like, that last category sometimes will be more interesting, but then you're getting into like deeper tech and IP and licensing deals with OEMs and hardware manufacturers. So that's the part that might be easier to scale.
So you invest in Audible thinking like this is going to 3D audio is going to be the future. This company is going to be a leader in it. Is that what you're assuming when you invest in that company, or that's what you're hoping?
That's a good example. I think this is a team that, like, basically, I think, you know how a few years ago you had the revolution in video where we all went to HD?
Right, yeah.
Like, we all went from, like, regular TVs to, okay, now, like, over maybe 3-4 years, everyone now.
Remember the Blu-ray revolution when, like, people thought Blu-rays were so cool, and now I'm like, those were so lame.
But when you think about music, like, the standard in music, and just not just music, sound, like, whether it's sound in a video or a conference call or this podcast that you're doing, like, it's been stereo, right? Left and right. And stereo sound, like, you see equalizers, like, sometimes people will add more bass or more treble, but that's,
right.
That's been it. Like, there hasn't been any innovation in a few years later, now everyone's buying, $200 headphones, but still, listen to sound in old stereo. So when I first got exposed to Audible Reality, like, understanding that they had created technology that were basically tapping into like other dimensions of your brain to trick your brain in hearing audio in 3D, but still using stereo inputs and outputs, I was blown away. I was like, oh wow, like this is like going from like regular TV to HDTV, potentially for the whole sound industries. So music, video, call conferencing, podcasting. So that's why we got interested in that company.
How can you, there? Can you try that? There was something that was just announced. I think, did Spotify do a partnership for 3D audio? There was something, but like, I've never had a 3D audio experience really. Do I just have to wait for it to become more mainstream?
You can download the Audible Reality app now. They launched it.
And then use it. August.
Yeah, you can use it on iOS or Android. And,
okay, I'm going to do that this afternoon.
Connect to Spotify. I think you need to have a Spotify premium account or music on your iPhone or smartphone. But you can try it now. And one of the things they're doing that's interesting, that could be interesting for your audience, is that they're doing partnerships with musicians or producers where, like, the thing with the Audible Reality is that it changes how you hear music, right? It's not changing the music. It's changing how you hear it. So you could do things like, I'm Zach, I'm going to create, and they call it vibes. So I'm Zach, I'm going to create a vibe that replicates how I love to listen to music, or how I like music to sound in my studio, or how I like music to sound in this venue that I love, right? So you can play wow. with settings, and then you can distribute that through Audible Reality, and eventually revenue share with the company if people buy or get or subscribe to these vibes. So they're now they're seeing more and more artists, and for artists, it's one more way to monetize.
And who buys a vibe? Is it like a fan that wants to hear a sound in Madison Square Garden, essentially, or is it?
Yeah, more or less, it's fans that like get that one experiment with listening to music in 3D this way, and that's a good example. Like eventually, you're gonna have the Madison Square Garden vibe, or the, you know, the listening room vibe if you want something more intimate. Okay. But the end goal is that. Like they're using, so while people listen to these vibes, they're able to identify how each person listens to music, and even granularly, like how you like to listen to hip hop might be different than how you like to listen to country music or to jazz music. So eventually the algorithm will recognize that if you're Zach and you're putting on a hip hop track, you like it when it sounds like this, where if the bass is slightly like around your head and the vocals are right in front. And actually the long-term vision is that sound will adapt individually to each of us, depending on our preferences.
It's the Nest of audio. It's adjusting your preferences. That's a bad example.
Let me think about it.
Shoot me down. So how do you, so I guess BeatDap would kind of be in that second category of building tech for the industry.
Yeah, they're building tech for the industry. At the same time, they're kind of building infrastructure for the industry. And I know you had Andrew and you
yeah,
had
yeah, yeah.
those guys on your show. It was a really good episode. But yeah, I guess they're like, what I like about, like what I was saying earlier, like I spent years at Banzugo and Bandcamp, like selling technology to like indie artists with, you know, small fan bases or indie labels, that may be struggling. Like I think BeatDap was smart in going after like major labels at first and really going like the old saying, follow the money. Like they went straight to the money and identified like who was leaving money on the table with the current state of things and said, we can fix this. And those guys are amazing and getting the right people to pay attention at the right time. So it's still early in that startup's journey, but I think right now they're making all the right moves to be in a position to start scaling and really make a difference for the industry.
Those guys are badass. I just like those guys. They're cool guys and they're tackling something noble, I think.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's noble, but also smart. Like I've seen years ago, we would see tons of blockchain startups that were saying, we're going to save the industry. But most of them were going at it again, like saying, we're going to help indie artists.
Right. Earn more
money. And I think that's great. And that's a great mission. But I think that's going to trickle top down. That's going to trickle from major labels working with the major platforms in bringing more transparency and accountability. And down the line, that's going to end up helping the indie label and artists.
Absolutely. So are you looking at any, because I know you invested in Sidedoor. Are you looking at any, well, I guess you have your live streaming company. What's like any thoughts about what's going to happen in the live streaming space? Like, is a leader going to emerge? Are we going to be able to live with all these live streaming companies and platforms that exist? Like, do you think about that space at all?
That's one deck I get every day, like at least every week. I see a new
live stream company.
Sidedoor is a personal investment, so that's one of my more angel investments. And the founder is a friend of mine, and initially Sidedoor was is and it still is, like, Sidedoor is meant to be a network for live music in non-traditional venues. So like a network and a marketplace, think of an Airbnb, but for house concerts or concerts in, you know, non-traditional venues that are not
the
that you're used to. They were making good progress when, you know, lockdown hit. I think they were smart to quickly switch to an online model. Like, they were one of the first I saw. Because then after a few weeks of panic, like, you started seeing artists saying, I'm going to be on Facebook Live, or I'm going to do this and YouTube. And Sidedoor was one of the first companies to realize that, like, these events needed to be ticketed. Like, have your fans pay, even if it's not a huge amount. Limit the number of tickets, like, create some scarcity. And do these online events with a small number of your fans so that they'll want to pay for that exclusive and scarce and personal connection. So they already had the ticketing infrastructure. And so they worked hard. At first it was just using basic Zoom, but really, like, worked at optimizing how they're using live streaming to give a good experience. They've seen about 100 probably new competitors come into the space, and all flavors of it, right? Like, live conferences, live events, live team calls, live happy hours. I think the leader in most of these use cases is still Zoom, with Microsoft and Google spending a lot of money to catch up. So are there going to be a lot of niche players that I'm looking at one right now that's trying to solve the, like, how do you have happy hours and kind of informal meetings with your employees, with your team, when you can't meet in person? So they're trying to, like, the more fun, gamified aspect of video conferencing. But at the same time, I don't know if any of these companies are going to be able to scale. It's a tough one. And then eventually we'll go back to the office and go back to.
But also, like, aren't a lot of these things the kind of things where, like, if they worked really well, the bigger players would just rip them off? Like, isn't it kind of a hard game to play?
Probably. I think it's hard to, like, it's hard to find ways to differentiate and find, like, tech things, like technology you can build that's going to give you a moat or, like, a defensible advantage over your competition. One of our portfolio companies, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging or.
Please brag. Come on, let's go. So,
okay, I will. So we have this company named LifeScale. That started out as a live streaming provider that you could use, like, if you want. And their thing is that they use multi-cloud, so they optimize if they're going to use, you know, Amazon or Microsoft, or in how they serve the streams, and then multi-platform. So you're serving the same stream on your website, on your app, on Facebook, on YouTube, like, anywhere you want. So they started with that, and maybe a year and a half ago, so well before COVID and any of that nonsense, they decided to not pivot, but to focus on commerce, like live shopping events. So live streams, they built the infrastructure to make them transactional. So you can click and buy, and it's integrated with whatever commerce backend, a merchant or retailer or brand.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So when lockdown hit, like, the biggest early customer was L'Oreal Canada. So a few brands of L'Oreal in Canada. So when COVID hit, like, shopping malls shut down, L'Oreal came back to them and said, we want to expand in the US and worldwide. So they were one of the, you know, multiple live streaming platforms, but they had that edge of having that commerce capability. So I do think other startups, if they want to dominate any of their sectors or you know, market segments, they need to think, like, what else can my platform have that's going to be unique, more than just a nice interface and the same features that everyone has.
Totally. David, I won't keep you. Thank you so much for taking the time. But before I let you run, you had recently said in a Forbes article that now is actually going to be a great time for investing and, you know, for the next couple months and throughout the next couple of years. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Is now also a good time to be an entrepreneur because of that? Like, what does that look like in this kind of crazy COVID environment?
Well, I mean, this is an environment that is forcing disruption, right? People are forced to adapt. Sadly, a lot of people have lost their jobs or will, or so I do think, and there is capital available, like maybe eventually the VC funds will dry up and it'll be harder, but for now, there are a lot of VC firms with a lot of capital to expand. I do think that a lot of people, if they've been laid off, it's the perfect time to launch a startup or try something, you know, work on that thing you've been thinking of. I think that technology is there to, like right now, technology to take an idea, like go from idea to early product is so much cheaper and easier and simpler to use than it was 10 years ago. So I do think it's the perfect time to be launching and experimenting. And so it is a good time for us to be investing. I think when I did that interview, my prediction was that valuations will go down in the markets, which we haven't really seen quite yet, to my surprise. So maybe that part isn't as true as it was. But when you look at like the last crisis was 2008-09, and a lot of the major tech companies you see today were created in those years. And you know, when you're in a tough environment, it forces you to be frugal, to focus on the right thing, and maybe, you know, go in more incremental steps, not like Quibi we mentioned at the beginning of the talk.
Full circle.
So I think it makes for more resilient companies and founders.
What's the way, like, if you're living in Nashville right now, you're like, I've got this brilliant music startup idea. It's going to disrupt. I need a VC fund. What's like, how do you attract a VC fund, or what's the best way to do it? It's the best way to do it to say, I don't need money. And then they all come after you. Like what's the best way to reach out to someone?
Well, the best way is to, it's still through networks. Like, I like to, like we get bombarded, right, by requests and decks, as you said. And if a deck and a referral is coming from one of our founders that we've already backed, like if Andrew at BeatDap sends me a deck, because he knows what we look for and because we know at what stage we want to invest and in what types of startups, like I'll give this one my attention.
You take it seriously.
So it's still the best way to reach out. But then, you know, I think if you're successful, right, if you're able to get customers on revenue, people will pay attention and investors are smart about that. And when you're getting started, I think, especially if you're a first time founder, like joining a good incubator or accelerator, you know, in order to kind of professionalize your approach and make sure you have good coaching, is a good way to do it. And then often that trickles up to you meeting investors. So that's usually a good place to start.
What do you read? Do you read every day, or are you a big, like any favorite books or news sources that you look at, or anything specific that you always check out?
I'm trying to, I read a lot of blogs, a lot of articles. So like I've slowed down I have so many books where I've read a few chapters and I'll go back to it. Not like I'm reading a book right now on the first like French explorers of Canada and North America.
Wow.
That would travel, you know, find the rivers, the unexplored rivers, and meet, you know, native tribes for the first time and negotiate for furs and things like that. And it's fascinating. And it's like completely outside of my business line of work, but at the same time seeing like these were true entrepreneurs, you know, going into the Canadian winter with only like furs and a canoe to, you know, discover new rivers and new populations and probably get killed by them. So that's my current book that I'm reading.
The Canadian Entrepreneurs. Fair. Any favorite music books that you love or anything on the industry?
I still think if anyone who hasn't read, what's it called? This Is Your Brain on Music. It's written by a guy who was a famous producer and then became a neurology professor. So it's about how music impacts your brain and why we enjoy music, why we enjoy dancing, and all the way down to why classical music is made and why we enjoy certain octaves and tone, and it's brilliant to understand, especially if you're not a musician, but even if you're a musician, if you want to understand the science behind music, this is an amazing book.
This is your brain on music.
10 or 15 years old, so it's not new.
I'm thinking of something else, but I've got to read this.
If you Google "This is your brain on music," you'll find it. It's Daniel Levitin. I just remember his name. Daniel Levitin is the main author.
Okay, I'm going to check it out. Last question, because you mentioned you're such a music guy. Any music recommendations? Anything you're listening to right now that's got you jazzed?
Oh, my music tastes are so over the place. I've been listening to this band, I guess, named Kompromat, Kompromat. It's a French electronic producer matched up with a German singer. And so it's like electronic, weird, danceable music.
Wow, and okay.
It's been I think it's perfect pandemic music when you're...
I'm going to check this out. This sounds cool. Is this on Bandcamp? Is that the best way to listen?
Yeah, I think it's on all the platforms. The guy behind it, his artist name is Vitalik. He's a semi-famous, I guess, well-known electronic artist from France. But under the moniker Kompromat, they made this, I think, a fantastic record of, I don't understand German, which, it's perfect.
I just watched the Blackpink K-pop documentary on Netflix, and they speak a little bit of English in their music, but now I've been listening to K-pop, and it's, I don't understand Korean, but I'm I'm obsessed with this. What is this? It's just a flow. I just like listening to it.
Yeah, it's I think it's cotton candy. You never grow out of liking cotton candy.
They say Dennis Pop, the Swedish producer who was Max Martin's mentor, in his book, he talks about word math and how English wasn't his first language, but because of that, he would take words in English that he thought just sounded good, even if they weren't perfect English, he would just string them together. And he called that word math. And I feel like that's kind of like this K-pop thing is it's very word mathy. Where even though I don't know what it is, it just sounds good. It's got it just flows to it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm the same, right? I grew up speaking French. So my early days, my understanding of English was very basic. And a lot of the bands I love as a child or a teenager, now that I actually get the lyrics, they're pretty stupid. But
right.
But it sounded really good to me, right? So I do think English as a language has that as that aspect to it where you can really use your voice and your lyrics as an instrument more than poetry, you know what I mean?
Right, totally.
Not that a lot of Anglophone music is really intricate in terms of lyrics and all that, but you can get away with it in English more than you can in French or other languages.
Absolutely. David, thank you for taking the time. This was so fun. I love talking with someone who is not someone I've normally had on this podcast. I've never had a VC or an investor or anything like that. So I love talking about that with you. Thanks for taking the time. And I hope we get the chance to meet in person if you're ever in Nashville, let me know.
Yeah, I want to come. I love Nashville. I want to come back as soon as my government will allow it.
Fair enough. And we will be happy to have you.
It has been an honor and a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Zach.
Far too kind. Talk to you soon. Stay well.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in. And thanks again to David for taking the time to talk with us. Really enjoyed it. Hope we get the chance to do it again soon. Maybe even next time we could do it down in Nashville. Who knows? Maybe I'll go up to Canada. I don't know. I've never been to Canada. I gotta go. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything @NashvilleBriefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Bye.